Okay, so actually, if you can turn to page 18, I know it's a little voracious. I had a request yesterday, which I thought was a good idea, actually, to do something on voracious as well, because voracious is a parsha that no one ever learns properly. Not that we can learn it properly, you could spend 10 years on voracious, but... especially this year, there was like not even a week for Bereshis, you know. Even in the holidays, there wasn't even a holiday week. It was like one day. So we'll do two things today. We'll touch on something from Bereshis, something from Noach. The Bereshis one is something I've touched on very briefly in Shul on Shabbos Bereshis, but I'm going to just explain it, elaborate it a bit. So if you have a look at page 18, it's the story of Cain and Hevel, but let's have a look at it from the beginning. If you look at page 18 at the bottom, the Parshas Bereshis obviously is a very action-packed parsha, like on all levels. First of all, it spans almost 1,000 years, or more than 1,000 years until Noach. 10 generations. Bereshis and Noach. By the time we finish Bereshis and Noach, we're up to almost the end of 2,000 years already of creation, and then the Torah slows down after that from Avram Avinu, and also just amazing things. I mean, Bereshit obviously is the Sheshes of Bereshit, the 6 days of creation, which in themselves is unbelievable. Second of all, you have the story of the Chet Etz Hadas, the sin of the fruit, also a very, very complicated story. And then we have the story of Cain and Hevel, which also often just doesn't get learned properly, but it's a very interesting story, and we'll just touch upon it. So the bottom of page 18, it says the following. Perek Dalet, chapter 4, Pasuk Aleph, verse 1. It says, V'ha'odom yoda eschava ishtoi. So the Torah goes back to the beginning of creation, and it says, the man knew his wife, Chava. In other words, Adam and Chava were intimate. V'tahar, she got pregnant. V'teled eskain, she gave birth to Cain. It says eskain, which we'll see the significance of that in a minute. V'toymer, she said, konisi isha shashem. I've acquired a man with Hashem. And Hashem has allowed me to acquire a child. Matoisef Aleda, she continued to give birth. Es Ochiv, his brother, Es Hevel, which was Hevel. By he, Hevel, Roye Tzoin, Hevel became a farmer, meaning a farmer, an animal farmer. He raised animals. Kain Hoyo Oved Adomo, and Cain was the servant of the ground, meaning he was a farmer, he toiled the ground, he worked the ground. So that's the two divisions of labor that they took. Hevel was the animal farmer, Cain was the ground farmer, the agricultural farmer. By him he kates yomim, and it was the after a period of time. By yovei Cain mipriu adam minchal Hashem, and Cain brought from the fruit of the ground, from the produce of the ground, I should say, minchal Hashem, a sacrifice for Hashem. The Hevel. Havi gam hu mi bechayrei soynoi u'mechil vehen. Hevel also brought himself from the choicest of the flock and from the best part. Vayisha Hashem es Hevel. Hashem turned to Hevel. Ve'el min chosem means Hashem responded to Hevel and to his korban, meaning that Hashem sent a fire, we are told, to consume the korban, the sacrifice of Hevel. Ve'el kain el min chosoi loisha. But to Cain and his korban Hashem did not respond. Vayichal Cain me'od. Cain was extremely upset. Vayiplu ponov, and his face fell, his countenance fell. The next pasuk is a hard pasuk. Vayomer Hashem, or to next two pasukim. Vayomer Hashem l'Cain. Hashem said to Cain, Loma charalach, why are you angry? Loma nofle ponecha, why is your face fallen, so to speak? Right? Haloim Taisiv says, it's very simple. If you improve yourself, you obviously done something wrong. That's why I'm not upset and happy with you. If you improve yourself, says, it's good, you'll be forgiven. Bimloi, and if not, then Lapeta Chatos Roivet, sin crouches at the door, which means, in other words, sin is always there to trap someone. So if you're not interested in improving yourself, then, Elecha Chakosoi, sin is always out there to get you, Baltahim Shoboy. Yet you can conquer it. It's up to you to conquer transgression or not. Okay, he didn't listen. So what happened was like this, says the pasuk. By Yoimer Cain El Hevel. Cain said to Hevel, it doesn't say what he said to him, it says he had a conversation with him. And it was when they were in the field. Vayakom Cain el Hevel. Cain rose up against Hevel. Vayahargeu, and he killed him. Yeah. And of course, Vayomer Hashem el Cain. Hashem said to Cain, Ei Hevel Achicha, where's Hevel your brother? Vayomer lo yadayti, he said, I don't know. Hashem Rochi Anochim, I'm my brother's keeper. Famous words. Vayomer, and he says, Me'asisa, what did you do? Killed me Achicha, Tzorakim Elayim and Adoma, blood of your brother's soul is crying out to me from the ground. And so on, he cursed him and he punished him. And after seven generations, Cain was killed. Okay. So this is the story, a troubling story, of course. Part of the issue of the story is that it's very cryptic. We actually don't know what happened here. It doesn't say exactly why Hashem didn't respond to Cain. It didn't say exactly what his korban was. And more importantly, when it says that he killed his brother Hevel, they had some sort of altercation, had some sort of conversation. It doesn't actually say what the conversation was. Also, when did the story happen? What's behind the story? And so on and so forth. So I'm going to share with you, first of all, some midrashim about what actually went on here, and then we'll try and understand the depth behind it. So first of all, when were Cain and Hevel born? This is also an interesting thing to understand. Does anyone know? Sorry? On the Friday, the same day as the Cain Adam and Chava. One of the midrash says many miracles happened that day. One of the miracles that happened that day was that Chava conceived and gave birth right away. Don't forget, this was before the curse that she received after she ate from the forbidden fruit, that childbearing would be hard. Right? So Cain and Hevel were actually born. She conceived and she gave birth. That's what Bereishis Rabbah says. Now, also what's interesting is that they were born with twin sisters. Now, if you have a look at the pasuk we started off with, right? Just interesting knowledge that not everyone's aware of. Vatois, it says, Vatelet Es Cain. She gave birth to Cain. Now, the word Es is always, we use the word Es. Es is a very interesting word. Es in the Torah has no real meaning. And then how do you translate the word Es? Right? Could say Vatelet Kain, she gave birth to Kain. What's Es Kain? Es Kain means like Es Kain, right? No, there's no English translation, but because we know that every time it says Es in the Torah, and it says many, many times, it actually comes to include something. It's teaching us something. For example, it says Kabid Es Avicha Ve'Esimecha. Honor your father and your mother. It doesn't have to say that. It could just say Kabid Avicha Ve'Imecha. Right? So we know, Chazal tell us, Es, for example, comes to include an older brother. Es comes to include a Torah teacher, and so on and so forth, right? So S always includes. In fact, the Gemara says, this famous thing in the Gemara, the Gemara has a discussion, the Gemara says, whoa, but hold on a second. S Hashem Elokecha Tira, it says you should fear Hashem your God. Right? What could that possibly include? Are we supposed to fear anything else besides God? Says the Gemara, yes, S Rabbis Talmud Chachamim. It comes to include Talmud Torah scholars. We have to have reverence for them as well because I guess they represent God and godliness and so on and so forth. So that's a whole discussion in the Gemara. So S comes to include something. Now you see with Cain it says Vatelet Es Cain, right? When it came to Hevel, it says Vatoisef lo ledes, she continued to give birth, Es Achiv, Es Hevel. So there's one S by Cain, there's two S's by Hevel. Say Chazal, that with Cain was born one twin sister, with Hevel was born two twin sisters. So Cain was a twin and Hevel was a triplet. Right? Why is it significant? Because we'll see later, but also there's a pasuk that says, this is a hard thing to understand, to get out of head rounds, but this is what the Chazal tell us. How did the world continue? Right? There were no other people there. So there's a pasuk that says, Oilam chesed yibone. The world is built on chesed, a special kindness from Hashem. What does that mean? That although after the generation of Cain and Hevel, incestual relationships became completely prohibited and still prohibited, but for that generation was permitted. Otherwise, the world wouldn't continue, right? What's fascinating is, if you look at the word chesed, actually sometimes means an intimate relationship, and sometimes it can be a negative one also. If you look in the Parshas Vayikra in Achrei Mois Kedoshim, where it talks about all the prohibited relationships, you know, the adultery and the incest and so on and so forth, when it talks about not having relations with a brother and a sister, it says ki chesed, it calls it a chesed, but that's negative chesed. And therefore it says it's prohibited. But with Cain and Hevel, they were permitted to marry their siblings because that's the only way the world could continue. That's the way the world did continue, and that's why Chazal tell us that's hinted in the pasuk, "Olam Chesed Yibona." The world was built on Chesed; otherwise, it wouldn't continue. Right? Now we'll see. This extra twin became problematic, as we'll soon see. Okay. Now, so that was when Cain and Hevel were born. They were born on the same day as Adam and Chava, on the sixth day of creation. However, this story did not take place on that day. This story took place a lot later. When did it take place? So it took place one spring, meaning Northern Hemisphere spring. The Midrash says, according to most opinions, some say it was Rosh Hashanah or Shavuos, but the Midrash we're going to go with at the moment says it was actually the 14th of Nisan. The 14th of Nisan, the Targum Yonasan ben Uziel and the Pirkei de Rabbi Elazar tell us that Adam HaRishon foresaw that on this day the Yidden, his descendants, would have to bring a special korban, a korban Pesach, right? And he told Cain and Hevel that it would be, he suggested to them that they do the same thing. That Erev Pesach, 4th of Nisan, they bring a korban to Hashem. We'll see later, he didn't tell them which korban to bring, but he told them to bring a korban. Hevel, as it turns out, brought a similar korban to the korban Pesach, because he brought a lamb, a sheep, right? Tzoyin. Cain didn't. Cain brought something from the ground, and that was the beginning of the issue. Okay. Some say, as I mentioned on Yom Shabbos, that Cain brought flaxseed, which we'll soon see the significance of that in a minute. But that was it happened. Okay, so Cain brought a korban, Hevel brought a korban. It seems that Hevel's korban was more superior to Cain's. Hashem accepted Hevel's korban, he didn't accept Cain's korban, and that's when all the trouble started. So they go into the field, and they have this machlekes. So it says, Vayoymer el Hevel, he said to Hevel. But the pasuk doesn't tell us what he said to Hevel. What was the argument? What was the discussion that eventually came to the murder of Hevel, where Cain murders Hevel? So there's four possible things that, according to the Midrashim, there's four possible conversations they had. One was, who was going to marry this third sister? Right? It was the issue of jealousy. Hevel said, well, it's his sister, so it belongs to him. Cain said, well, he's the older one, so he gets the extra sister. So that was the machlokes. Now that has a lot to do with, because I'm not going to go into today, but there's a whole thing about the whole thing about this machlokes between Cain and Hevel involved a number of different bad traits, and one of them was jealousy, right? Because there was machlokes, there was jealousy, and there was murder. I haven't looked at this for a while, so let me just see if I remember. That's fascinating, because later in that the Arizal in the Sefer HaGilgulim. I wasn't going to say this, but let me just share it with you, because I think it's actually fascinating if I can remember it. In Sefer HaGilgulim, the Arizal goes through a whole bunch of different fascinating stuff about the reincarnations of Cain and Hevel, right? Because we know Hevel was reincarnated into Shais, his brother, who was born after him, and ultimately reincarnated into Moshe Rabbeinu. So Moshe Rabbeinu was a Gilgul of Hevel, right? Cain was reincarnated in three people. The Mitzri, and every pasuk has a hint to it to prove this, but the Mitzri, the Egyptian that Moshe Rabbeinu killed. Korach was a Gilgul of Cain, apparently. And Yisroi. So that's what happened. So why? And each one had to do with Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu killed the Mitzri in Mitzrayim. Moshe Rabbeinu interacted with Yisroi and married his daughter. And Moshe Rabbeinu interacted with Korach, and ultimately Korach was punished. So I once saw a whole fascinating explanation of why that is. Because Cain had three averus. One was jealousy about the daughter, about the sister, the extra sister. One was just generally the concept of machlokes. He fought with Hevel, that concept of division. And the other one was murder. And because of that, the neshama of Cain needed a tikkun. It needed a rectification. So it had to be rectified through Hevel, through a Gilgul of Hevel, which is Moshe Rabbeinu, in three different stories having to do with all these three things. So when Moshe Rabbeinu killed the Mitzri, who was the Gilgul of Cain, that rectified the sin of murder. And by the way, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't kill the Mitzri the same way Cain killed. He killed it verbally. He said the name of Hashem and he died. And him dying, meaning a kill, was the Gilgul of Cain, rectified the sin of murder which Cain had carried out. When he met Yisroi, and he married Yisroi's daughter, that was a tikkun for the whole thing about the jealousy of about the machlokes over the third sister. And then Korach was a tikkun for the whole concept of machlokes. because obviously that was the whole idea, the punishment of Korach, rectify the whole concept of Machlekes, and that's how all the three aspects of Kain were eventually fixed, through this concept of Gilgul, which is a fascinating thing. Okay, but I don't remember exactly how it fits into all the Psukim, it's very, very fascinating. I want to get a whole shiur in it, in the concept of Gilgul. Very, very fascinating idea. Okay. So so that was one particular discussion they might have had. According to the Medrash, they fought over the third sister. The second one is, they knew that they were the only two sons of Adam at the time, and therefore the world belonged to them. And a fascinating thing the Medrash says, they fought who was going to inherit the spot of the Beis HaMikdash. Now that's a separate discussion of what that actually means and why they were arguing about that. But that's one thing. And the second is, they had a machlokes about, because we know that Cain took the land, and Hevel took the animals, right? So Cain says to Hevel, when he went into the field, and he dafka picked a fight with Hevel, because he wanted to kill him, actually. So he says, what are you doing walking on my ground? Ground belongs to me. Hevel says, what do you want me to do? He said, fly. I don't know. It's my ground. So Hevel said to Cain, well, what if I don't have permission to walk on your ground, who gave permission to wear my clothes? He was wearing, presumably, woolen clothes or clothes that made things from the ground. So therefore, Hevel said, well, if it's your land, it's my clothes. So anyway, that was one possible machlekes. And then there was a spiritual machlekes, which we'll see later what that actually means on a deeper level. They fought over the world to come, whether this world is the only world, or there's a world, there's an olam haba, and they had a philosophical discussion, and that was part of the machlekes, that's part of the argument that led to, ultimately, the murder of Hevel. Okay. However, what I want to do is I want to share with you two deep ideas behind the machlokes between Cain and Hevel. And the one is a fascinating biur, fascinating explanation gathered from the Mefarshim, which has to do with Pesach, because this happened on Erev Pesach, and also has to do with the mitzvah in the Torah about not wearing, wool and linen, shatnez. Okay? Now, the Avera of wool and linen has to do with, is a chok, it's one of the chokim. According to most Mefarshim, Rishonim, it's a chok, one of the chokim, shatnez, one of the things we don't understand, which leads into a whole other thing in the Torah about chokim, whether we are permitted to explore reasons for the chokim. Right? The Rambam says we are, other Mefarshim will say we are, and essentially when we talk about a chok, whether it's meat or milk or shatnez or these kind of things, we are allowed to investigate symbolisms and ideas behind those mitzvahs, although we accept that the ultimate reason we may not know, because ultimately belongs to the category of chukim. Now So some of the Mefarshim say that the isur, the prohibition of shatnez, which essentially is to have wool and linen in a garment at the same time, comes back to the concept of Cain and Hevel. Why? Hevel brought a korban from the sheep, from wool, always the source of wool. And according to the Medrash, and Rashi brings it down also, as I mentioned on Shabbos, that Cain brought a korban from flaxseed, where you make linen out of. Right? And because we see that Hashem accepted Hevel and rejected Cain, so we see this concept of rejection and not mixing the wool and linen together. In other words, Hevel had one acceptance, Cain was rejected, therefore we don't mix them together. That's some of the Mefarshim say, it goes back to them. But we need to try and explore that. What does it actually mean? Right? So, here's an interesting explanation. The Rambam says, by the way, who always tries to offer as much as rational explanation to the mitzvahs as he can, that's just the derech of the Rambam. The Rambam says that the isur, the prohibition of shatnez, has to do with not going in the ways of Avodah Zarah. And he says, when the Torah was given, it was common practice for pagan priests to wear garments of wool and linen. The Rambam even goes as far as to say that he testified that in the 12th century where he lived in Egypt, he said garments of wool and linen were very popular among idolatrous priests. That's what he says. Okay. Which itself, okay, and therefore because the Torah tells us to stay away as much as we can from any practice that has to do with Avodah Zarah, which by the way the Rambam explains that's the same thing why we have to have payas. Right? Because it was the way of priests to actually cut off the payas and to make the hair cut round. Therefore, there's a problem with payas. Rambam puts it, in fact, the halachas of payas that Rambam puts into the laws of Avodah Zarah. That's if you'll find them in the laws of Avodah Zarah. That's what the Rambam includes. Like the Rambam has a very systemized, very interesting system, he categorizes all these halachas when he put together the Rambam. And the halachas of not cutting off the payas actually is found in the laws of Avodah Zarah. Right? Because the Rambam says that's the same reason. So there are many, many things that the Rambam explains in the Torah that the Torah prohibited because the Torah wanted to keep us very distant from the practices of Avodah Zarah, of idol worship, right? Okay, that might be so, but the question is, we have to understand, that's really weird. What is the reason that pagan worshippers or pagan priests would wear wool and linen? What's the symbolism? What was behind the wool and linen concept, right? So let's go back to this story of when Cain and Hevel actually happened. Okay. So we say it happened Erev Pesach. Adam HaRishon says they should bring a korban. But Adam HaRishon doesn't tell them which korban to bring. Yeah? So why? He wants them to choose. He wants to see where their heart is going to go and what their korban is going to symbolize. So what happened is, Hevel senses that this is the day of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Hevel senses this is the day where the Yidden are going to be free from the concept of Mitzrayim. So he celebrates, he connects to that concept, and he brings a korban similar to the korban that the Yidden brought when they went out of Mitzrayim, i.e. the sheep, the lamb. Hevel Cain doesn't do that. Why not? Because the Mekubalim tell us, the mystics tell us, that Cain and Hevel actually become the spiritual source for the two sides in creation. The side of Kedusha and the side of Klippa, the side of holiness and the side of the opposite of holiness. Embodied in the B'nai Yisrael versus Mitzrayim. What's the difference between B'nai Yisrael versus Mitzrayim? So we know that the whole idea, when the Yidden were redeemed from Mitzrayim, what was the argument? What was the fight? What was the war between the Jewish people and Mitzrayim? Ultimately, it was a war between Avodah Zarah and Emunah. The Medrash tells us, "Bischus ha'Emunah," it was the merit of Emunah that the Yidden were freed from Mitzrayim. What it Paro symbolizes is exactly the opposite of Emunah. Paro symbolizes the ultimate ego, the ultimate self-centeredness, the ultimate denial of subservience and dependence on God. What was the famous line that Paro said? "Li yo'iri v'ani osasini." The river belongs to me, and I made it. In fact, the Nile River was actually a source of part of the pagan worship in Mitzrayim. Because Mitzrayim always had water. They had the river. It was always irrigated. Always every year overflows. And it was fine. Even when they went into Israel, had to pray for rain. Still pray for rain. Right? Even this year, it started to rain in the middle of Sukkot. Everyone was happy because it doesn't rain in Israel. Right? We get all grumpy when it rains in Sukkot. But they were happy. Right? Because it's a rain. It's rain that solves a big thing, right? So that's different because we know we've got to pray for rain. We've got to ask for rain because that's part of our emunah, right? And Mitzrayim Hashem gave them the water because that's Mitzrayim's challenge. Everything I create, everything depends on me, right? So, and that's why to the point where Paro actually made himself a deity, claiming that the Yo'er, the Nilus River, the Nile River, belongs to him and he made it. And as a result, one of the pagan practices of Egypt was to serve the Nile River. It became a source of Avodah Zarah, right? Cain doesn't connect to the Yidden. Cain goes against the Yidden. The Neshama of Cain is that force that challenges the Emunah of the Jewish people. Cain is the source of the Neshamas, of the souls which are Avodah Zarah, which are challenging unholy souls, so to speak, right? They can be challenged, they can be channeled, they can be elevated, but this is what it is in the meantime. Now, what's that got to do with the korbanos that they bring? What happens is, this expresses itself in the sacrifices that they bring. Because Hevel brings a lamb. The lamb was a symbol of Yetzias Mitzrayim, right? As we said before. What does Cain bring? Cain brings flaxseed. Now, I'm going to take you back. So interesting part of Bereshis. Give me 1 second. If I can find the others, I'll leave it. Ah. Okay. Have a look on page 12. Pasuk Yud. Also, very, very not unnoticed psukim. Every pasuk in Bereshit is like full, right? Just it's hard to spend time in it. But anyway, so he says pasuk Yud, Hashem created Gan Eden. Then there's the famous pasuk, V'nohar Yetzei Me'Eden. A river went out of Gan Eden. or Eden. Lahashkes Sagon, to water the gun Eden. By the way, from this passage we see Gan and Eden are two different places, that's a separate story. Anyway. Umishom Yiparid, and that river split, separated, Hoyal Arba Roshim, and became four primary rivers. Right? Shemo Echad, the first name, the first river that came from that river, is the river of Pishoin. Who are Soyvers, called Eretz HaVila, it goes around the land called Havila, Shom Azov, which was the where the gold was found. Have a look at Rashi. Pishoin, says Rashi. What's Pishoin? Hu Nilus, that's the Nile River, Nahar Mitzrayim. Why is it called Pishoin, Rashi says? Right? So one of the rivers that came out of this Nor, the river from Aden, is the river of Pishoin. Why is it that, which Rashi says is the Nile River? Why is it called Pishoin? Because, by the way, Gan Eden, they say, somewhere in that region, right? I don't know where, but it's somewhere in, coming from that, near Eretz Israel, near that region, the region of the world. Says Rashi, why is it called Pishon? Two reasons. It's because its waters are blessed and rise and irrigate the land. Nikra Pishon, it's called Pishon, because Pishon means to spread. Right? That's one translation of the word Pishon. Dovar Acher, another Pshat, says Rashi, Pishon, that level is called Pishon, that river is called Pishon, Shumagadil Pishton, because it makes the flax grow. Shenemal Eitzu Mitzrayim, because there's a pasuk which says in Yeshayo, when it talks about Mitzrayim, Uboshu Oivdei Pishtim. The Egyptians were called the growers of flax, the flax growers. Right? And that's why Cain brings a korban of flax. Because Cain is connecting to Mitzrayim, not to Yetzias Mitzrayim. Because Cain is connected to the challenge against Emunah and not Emunah. That's the source. That's the source. That's Cain's neshama. That's Cain's role in life almost. Right? That's why he challenges Hevel. That's why Moshe Rabbeinu had to fix Mitzrayim. Moshe Rabbeinu had to reverse it. Moshe Rabbeinu, who is Hevel, had to kill the Egyptian, had to take the Yidden out of Mitzrayim. Right? Moshe Rabbeinu had to deal with Korach. Korach is a Gilgal of Cain, even though he's a Yid. He came out of Mitzrayim. But nevertheless, what was Korach's issue? Korach's issue was Machloikas. Where does Machloikas come from? Machloikas is synonymous with Avodah Zarah. Right? The true... Yeah, you see the connection? No? Why? Where does unity come from? True unity. It's interesting, you know, we just came from Rosh Hashanah, right? True unity can only happen, real unity that is, when there's belief in Hashem. Why? Because when there's belief in Hashem, true belief in Hashem means that Hashem Echad, Hashem is one. But Hashem is one doesn't mean there's one God. Hashem is one means that ultimately there's only really one reality. Everything that Hashem created in the fragmented world, in the world of multiplicity, is ultimately only an expression of Hashem's infinity, and ultimately all has to be brought back to the one mission and the one connection, which is Hashem Echad, right? So when you have true emunah, if a person has real emunah, you never fight with anyone else. That's why anger comes from avodah zarah, machloikas comes from avodah zarah, because they're all expressions of a lack of emunah. If I really believed in Hashem, that Hashem runs everything and everything is an expression of Hashem, how can I get angry with someone else for doing something wrong to me? If I really, right? That's why the Gemara says, Kol HaKoyis, anyone who gets angry is as if he's serving Avodah Zarah. Why? Because ultimately anger, rage, is an expression of lack of Amunah. A subtle lack of Amunah, right? Machloikas is the same thing. If we really, really believed in the oneness of Hashem, then we're all here to express the same concept. We might do it a bit differently. So they can't really be machlokes. Territorialism, in other words, this thing belongs to me, it doesn't belong to you, all this kind of stuff, all comes from ego. Ego means I'm something else, I'm something independent. The whole idea of ego is avodah zarah. If a person was really completely believing in Hashem and completely dependent on Hashem's existence, and we knew we were all part of one reality and we're really nothing ourselves, we're not independent, so then what's there to be this place for everyone? How can they, right? So all the things that lead to disunity are all symptoms of lack of emunah. Ego, division, they're all symptoms of lack of emunah, which is a lack of Hashem Echad. That's why Korach is also a Gilgal of Cain. Cain is Mitzrayim. Cain is egocentricity. I made the river. either literally or people subtly think that. We all suffer from kind of a little here and there, right? Take it a bit further. I mean, truth is that, you know, there's a famous concept in Tanya where he explains that Hillel said to the convert who wanted to learn the whole Torah on foot, he told him, love your fellows yourself, or not, right? And that's the whole Torah. Why? He said, how can it be the whole Torah? He said, same thing, because how can a person really love another person like themselves? I mean, I'm not the other person. But if we understand that the main thing is the neshama, then we are the same person, because the neshama is all the same. We're only different externally, we're not different internally, right? Similar thing, we just came from Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. There we say a line, we ask Hashem, v'yosu kula maguda echos, we should all make one group, lasos ritzoncha b'leivav sholem, to do your will with a full heart, right? That's what we ask Hashem in Rosh Hashanah Davening. So I saw a pshat recently. What does it mean? The simple pshat is, Hashem should unite us all as one, so that we can do your will. No, pshat's all the way around. V'yosu kula maguda echos, Hashem should make us one group. When are we one group? When are we really one group? Only when we're doing Hashem's will. If we're not focused on Hashem's will, we're not really one group. Which is why the Pirkei Avos says, you often see in the world, actually, it's not only Pirkei Avos, you see in the world, people seem to be united, but really they all have their own agendas. And it comes out later, they start infighting. Why? Because they're never really united. That's why in Pirkei Avos is a fascinating line about Korach, actually. In Pirkei Avos it talks about a machloikas l'shashem shemayim, machloikas that's for the sake of heaven, or a machloikas not for the sake of heaven. It says, what's an example of machloikas that not that for the sake of heaven? Hillel and Shammai. That's a good machloikas, right? When they argue about pshat in Torah. Says the Pirkei Avos, what's an example of machloikas that's not l'shem shemayim? Korach va'adosai, Korach and his mob. So the first one asks the question, the wording is strange. It shouldn't say, what's an example of machloikas not l'shem shemayim? It should say, Korach and Moshe Rabbeinu, not Korach and his mob. Korach and his mob weren't fighting. They were together. They were all rebelling against Moshe Rabbeinu. So if you want to give an example of a division of a machloikas that's not l'shem shemayim, not l'shem of heaven, just say Korach and Moshe, right? The first one says no, because Korach and Adosai also were fighting. You think they were united? They weren't united. They were united in their cause to rebel against Moshe Rabbeinu, but they all had their own agenda. Each one wanted to be the Kohen Gadol. So they would have, if they would have been kept alive, ultimately they would have ended up fighting with each other. Right? Because true unity can only be... Let me think. So that's why... Oh, so now we can understand a few things. So that's why Kain brings the flax seed. Flax seed is Pishon, the river Pishon, which is the river Nile. Mitzrayim, because he's connecting to Mitzrayim. He's connecting to the opposite of Emunah. Hevel's bringing the sheep because that's Yetzias Mitzrayim. Right? So now we can understand what the Rambam says, that shatness, wool and linen, is a garment of Avodah Zarah. Because the priests of Avodah Zarah would they would wear garments of flax and linen. They would wear garments where the flax challenges, the wool and linen, where the linen challenges the wool. Dafka, because that's a symbol of Avodah Zarah. When you reject the flax and you wear a woolen garment without flax, that's a symbol of pure Emunah. But someone, the priests of Avodah Zarah, Dafka mix flax into their garments as a symbol of kind, as a symbol of ego, as a symbol of challenging the Emunah in Hashem. The flax wanted to fight with the linen, with the wool, right? And that's why the Torah says you shouldn't wear shatness. All got to do with the Kain and Hevel story. Because our job is to separate the two issues, to make sure we don't mix Avodah Zarah into our Emunah. Now, it doesn't mean we can't wear linen. We can wear linen separately. That's because we have to deal with it. But we can't mix the two. We can't let the Emunah be tainted by the linen. We can't let the Emunah be tainted by the Avodah Zarah. Right? If you deal with them separately, that's separate roster. You can fight, you can transform, like Moshe Rabbeinu did with Yisrael, and so on and so forth. But you can't mix the two from the linen, because it becomes a cholent of Emunah and the opposite of Emunah, and that's not a good thing. And that's going back to the reason of why the issue of shatness goes back to Kain and Hevel. It's got to do with Pesach and Erev Pesach and the particular korbanos they brought, and why Kain bought flax and he bought sheep. Interesting explanation. Yeah. The Mitzri, Yisrael, and Korach. Yeah, became, but that was but Yisrael was also originally a big servant of Avodah Zarah, right? But that was where the part of Cain that could be elevated was elevated, right? That's why there was a positive story. He married his daughter, on the contrary, yeah, you know, so. And Yisrael became a ger, and he served Hashem, and he rejected Avodah Zarah. Yeah, so he elevated Yisrael. Okay. just want to mention quickly, and I know this is for some people it's Chazara, but just another word of Kain and Hevel, which is a different perspective altogether, but I just want to mention it quickly. I mentioned on Shabbos, another explanation of the Machlokes was like this. We say that Hashem rejected Kain's carbon because it wasn't a nice, it was an inferior carbon. Hevel, he accepted his carbon because it was a superior carbon. However, if you look at it, it's interesting because Kain actually brought flax, the Gemara says, actually a very superior plant. It actually is considered a chasheva plant. It's an expensive thing, actually. Right? So what Kain did was, because the question also is like, why was Kain upset? Like, what was he thinking? He's going to bring like a shmata carbon and Hashem is going to accept it? I mean, like, what was he thinking? Right? The answer is like this. Kain brought a very, very expensive carbon, but from that plant itself, he chose the inferior part. Hevel did the opposite. Hevel didn't bring from the best of the animals. There are more expensive animals than sheep. There's cows, bulls, right? Bigger carbonas. He didn't. He took a smaller carbon, a sheep. Yet from the sheep, he brought the best sheep. Right? So there's an explanation that goes like this, that the machloek between Kain and Hevel was a philosophical thing. What's the better way to serve Hashem? Should you give big things, but in the big things like weak big things? Or keep it small, but give it your best, right? And we see what Hashem accepted, what he didn't accept. And that's a lesson for everyone. The lesson is a person sometimes, we're not all on the same level. Right? We see by Korach, that was Korach's problem. Korach wanted to be a Kohen Gadol. Not everyone has to be a Kohen Gadol. Right? We'll have to be who we are. And we're on different levels and that's fine. But within who we are, we have to be our best. Hevel's model. Right? Hevel says, I'm going to bring Tzoyim, but I'm going to bring the best sheep. Because if you try aim for a Madrega where you're not holding by, it'll end up being an inferior part of that level, and that's not a good thing. Whatever we give to Hashem has to be the best, has to be our best. How going out of our comfort zone, but what we can do, right? Our context. Like the famous word of Rav Zusha of Anipoli when he said that when he gets up to Shemayim, he's not worried they're gonna say to him, Zusha, why weren't you like Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov or Moshe Rabbeinu? He's just scared they're gonna say to him, Zusha, why weren't you like Zusha? In other words, why didn't you do your best? Right? That's the same idea. Okay. So that's the vort on Parshas Bereishis. I just thought it would be nice to take a little piece of Parshas Bereishis and responding to the request that we had. So it's normally an unlearned little part, so I thought it would be nice to explore a little bit. Now let's go to Noach. Noach is a famous story, of course. I'm going to share with you a concept of Noach. Also action-packed, also lots to talk about. The basic story everyone knows, the people had messed up. There was terrible corruption. Moral corruption, sexual corruption, financial corruption, and so on and so forth. And Hashem decided to put an end to it all and to bring a flood. Takes Noach and his family, puts them into a teva, and saves them that way. That's bringing all the animals in, and so on and so forth. It was a tough job Noach had. It was miraculous, but yet tough. They say that in the teva there was an avir of Mashiach, because that's when all the animals coexisted. Although it wasn't quite Mashiach, because Noach ran into trouble with a lion, it says. He brought his food late one day and he got kicked. So when Noach came out of the teva, he was pretty exhausted. Right? He was finished. Anyway, okay. Then there's an interesting little piece which I want to just touch on. Let me just find it. Give me 1 second. Where the teva comes to rest on a mountain called Mountain Ararat. And Noach can tell that the water had stopped raining and that now it's starting to go down. Starting to subside, but he didn't know exactly how much, right? So what does he do? Yeah, okay. If you have a look on page 36. What I'm going to share with you is an analysis on just understanding the simple pshat in the pasuk, which has certain problems. And it's interesting that the particular problem we're going to raise, Rashi doesn't address, which there's a rule, if Rashi doesn't address a problem, it must not be a problem in the simple pshat of the pasuk, meaning. Because Rashi's function is to explain all difficulties in the simple pshat, so we have to try to work it out ourselves. Obviously, Rashi didn't think it was that much of a problem, so we have to see. But there's an interesting problem that comes out here. There's a famous story with the raven and the dove. Also not a very overly learned parsha. So let's have a look. It says, Pasuk Vav, verse 6. Vayhi mikeitzar boim yoim, It was the end of 40 days. Vayiftach Noach. Noach opens up his chaloin hateva asher asa. He opened up the window of the teva that he had made. Oh, don't forget, when Noach made the teva, he made a window. Okay. What does he do? First, vayishalach es ha'oirev. He sends the raven. The raven wasn't really interested in the mission. Vayetze yotze v'shavad yivoshmei mal ha'oretz. And he just kept going back, and so that didn't work. Okay. So what does he do? Noach sends the yoina, the dav, three times. There's all kinds of first. We're not going to go into it now. I'm just saying it's also a very complicated piece. Vayishalach es ha'yoina me'itoi. He sent the dav from him, Lirois, to see, heikalu ha'mai. Has the water gotten a little bit less? Me'al pnei ha'adam. Has it gotten easier? First time, it says the pasuk 9. Le'motza yoina me'noach l'chav ragla. The dav couldn't find anywhere to rest. Atoshav eila v'lateva. The dav comes back to the ark. Kimayim apnei ha'aretz, because the water was still filling the, covering the earth. Vayishalach yodai, Noach puts out his hand. Vayova eiso elav alateva, and he brings him back into the teva. Vayochaloi shivas yom machodim, and Noach waits another 7 days. Vayosef shalach azayonim alateva, and he sends him again from the teva. Vatovoi elav hayoyna leis erev, the gav comes back towards evening. Vihine ale zayis torof befiha. There was a olive leaf plucked in its mouth. I will see later the significance of the word torof, plucked in its mouth. Vayeda Noach, Noach nu ki kalu hamayim ala oretz, that the water has subsided somewhat. But he didn't know that it was dry yet. He doesn't know if it was good enough for him to go out yet. But obviously it had revealed some of the trees, and there was obviously enough to bring a leaf and so on. Okay. Vayiyochel oyit shivas yom, so Noach waits another 7 days, acherim, vayishalach es ha'yoyna, and he sends the yoyna, v'layos v'shuv eilav oyit, and the yoyna, the dove doesn't come back. Which for Noach was a good sign, because meaning always he'd found where to rest, and therefore it was really getting to the point where it was getting dry. Okay. So this is how the story goes. Everyone knows the olive branch later becomes a symbol of peace, whatever the reason is. Right? Actually, it wasn't an olive branch, it was an olive leaf. But anyway, whatever the case is, and this is the story. The simple problem is, let's understand what this was. Right? This was after an amazing flood that had destroyed the entire world. Right? 40 days, the water pounded. Now, if you ever look at the footage from the hurricanes that we've been, right? It doesn't leave much there, including trees. If that's true with hurricanes, can you imagine how true it must be with a marble that covered everything, right? Where did this olive leaf come from? How was there an olive leaf after a flood like this, right? We would assume that a marble of that magnitude would have wiped out everything, including the trees. Now, we know this because later on in Parshas Noach, we find that Noach didn't only take animals into the teva, he took branches and seeds. Why? Because when he comes out of the teva, there's a famous story, also a very, very complicated story, of Shem, Chom, and Yofes, where Chom does an indecent act with Noach. Why did that happen? Because it says Noach planted a vineyard. What did he plant a vineyard? Rashi says because he took the vineyard with him into the teva. He knew when he comes out, there's not going to be a vineyard left. Right? So he plants a vineyard. Obviously, the pasuk says it in two sentences, but it was a story that took a number of years. He grows grapes. He makes wine out of the grapes. He drinks the wine, gets shikr inappropriately, and there's a story that happens over there, right? And then he curses Chom, and he blesses Shem, and Chom and so and Yofes and so on, right? So we see. So where does this olive tree come from? Now, what's interesting, Rashi doesn't mention anything, but if you look at the Midrashim try to address this. The problem is the way the Midrashim address it is not going to help us. It's not going to help. Again, when you learn Chumash, you always have to know, what are you learning? Are you learning Drush or are you learning Pshat? Now, they're both authentic parts of the Torah, but they learn differently. So you can't, unless Rashi tells us you could, and unless it makes sense to do that, you often cannot use things from Drush, right, some allegorical interpretations or alternative interpretation, deeper side of the Torah, you cannot use that to explain the simple Pshat. And over here too, the Medrash says, one approach is that the olive leaf came from Eretz Yisrael. Because there is an opinion in the Medrash that the flood didn't happen in Eretz Yisrael. Do you know that? Happened in the entire world except for Eretz Yisrael. Now, I didn't mean left anyone there because it looks like there was no one inhabiting Eretz Yisrael at the time. That only happened later. Don't forget, Gan Eden and around Gan Eden, which was Noach, and even where Avram was born, was near Eretz Yisrael, but not in Eretz Yisrael. It was more Mesopotamia, right? That area. And people, as they started to multiply after the flood, started to migrate to Eretz Yisrael, primarily the sons of Chom, which is why Eretz Yisrael became known and is known in the Torah as Eretz Canaan, right? Chom, the third son of Noach, had a son called Canaan. Canaan went to Eretz Yisrael, and his children, that's why it became known as Canaan. Afterwards, other nations came there, etc. But it was Canaan, so it's called the Canaanim, right? The land of the Canaanites. That only happened later. That happened after the flood. We have the first Rashi, of course, in Bereshis, that said that was only a temporary gift. That didn't become the Canaanites. It was always meant to be the Yidden, and so on and so forth. Okay. So therefore, they say it took the olive branch from Eretz Yisrael.
Why did it have to go out three times?
Oh, good question. Good, very good question. Okay. Maybe there was so much water it couldn't get to Eretz Yisrael. I don't know. Yeah. No, it's a very good question. I'll come back to that. I'll tell you more. I'll tell you a bigger problem. Second of all, the second part of the Medrash is that the olive branch came from Gan Eden. Went to Gan Eden? Gan Eden, obviously the flood didn't fall there. There is a place, by the way, called Gan Eden that apparently has physical trees. We don't know where it is. Right? Okay. Now, both interpretations are problematic in the Pshat. They're nice Midrashim and they mean whatever they mean, but in Pshat, they're problematic. First of all, in the simple reading of the Pshat, let's go backwards. It's difficult to say that the raven would have got, the dove would have gone to Gan Eden for two reasons. First of all, who's sitting in Gan Eden? We know that in the Bereshit it says that after Hashem kicked Adam and Chava out of Gan Eden, he put fiery angels at the door of Gan Eden to protect Gan Eden. How did the dove get into Gan Eden altogether? Second of all, then the whole thing doesn't make sense in Pshat. The whole point of Noach sending the dove to get it out, to get to see what we used to see if the land is drying up, if Noah can get out, what's it going to help if he goes to Gan Eden? Of course, in Gan Eden there was no flood. So he brings back an olive branch from Gan Eden. What does that tell me about the world? Noah needs to know if where he was living the world is, if he can go out. What's an olive branch from Gan Eden going to help you, right? And even the first shot. First of all, there's reasons we're not going to go into now, but there are reasons to. It doesn't say, it's not hinted anywhere in the simple reading of the Chumash that the flood didn't happen in Eretz Yisrael. It seems like it happened everywhere, from the simple Pshat in the Pasuk. And even if it didn't happen in Eretz Yisrael, what does that mean? It doesn't mean that there was no water in Eretz Yisrael, right? Because it didn't mean it didn't rain on Eretz Yisrael. But if there's this huge flood meters high, right next to Eretz Yisrael, you'd imagine that water flows. I mean, obviously there was a flood in Eretz Yisrael. It didn't rain on Eretz Yisrael, maybe, but there was certainly water there, right? Which comes back to the question, so how did the olive leaf survive? Yep. Now, another problem. To answer this question, let's bring another problem. And I'll share with you a chiddush that the Rebbe says in one of his Rashi talks. Very interesting chiddush. Second of all, like a different problem, right? Where's Noach? Noach is on Mountain Ararat. Olive trees grow all over the place, including mountains. How does Noach know that the water is subsiding on the ground? Like, Noach knew that the water is not anymore on the mountain. That was the whole idea, right? He only started this whole process after the Teva rested on Mount Ararat, which is one of the highest mountains. And Rashi says, because the mountain stuck out, and then from then the water started to go lower. But on the top of the mountain, it was fine. But no, that wasn't good enough for Noach. He needed to know if he can go down the mountain. So he sends out a dove, and the dove brings him an olive leaf. Maybe the olive leaf is 2 meters down on the mountain. What does that tell Noach about what's happening on the ground?
The raven never came back.
The raven didn't come back. No, he just circled until the end of the bubble. Right? You understand what I'm saying? So how does Noach know? What is it helping him? So he says the following chiddush. He says like this. No, the pshat was like this. It was a time issue. First of all, the Rebbe brings from Gemara. It is possible, although it is not probable or possible, that there be an olive leaf after the mabul, However, when it comes to olive trees, unlike vineyards, it is possible that there were still olive trees after the Mabul, because the Gemara says that olive trees are one of the strongest trees. It's a very, very strong tree. Right? Good. Oh, sorry, before I go, by the way, another problem. How does Noach know that the water is subsiding altogether? Maybe the leaf is a floating leaf on the water. Maybe it's a leaf broken off of the tree. He says the following. First of all, the trees survived. Olive trees did survive. Leaves sure didn't survive. The olive trees did survive, because the olive trees are an extremely strong tree. Okay. What happened here was different. Noach could tell, when the daf comes back, that this is a newly grown leaf that the yoina, the dag, had plucked off the thing. He knew it wasn't from the water, because you could tell the difference between an old leaf that's been floating around and a fresh leaf off a tree. And that's why, if you look very carefully in the pasuk, and that's where the answer really lies, it says that the daf came back, vine alei zayis, there was an olive leaf, toraf befiho, plucked from its mouth. He could tell the yoina had plucked a tree, plucked a leaf off the tree, right? In other words, what Noach could tell like this, he doesn't mind if it's a tree on the mountain. Because even if it's a tree on the mountain, it still means that tree was revealed and had enough time to grow a new leaf. From that, Noach could tell that the mortar must be very low, much lower than the olive tree, even if this leaf is from an olive tree on the mountain. Because the tree was there from before the Mabul. The leaves couldn't have been there before the Mabul. The leaf had now grown, but it takes time for a leaf to grow. A tree submerged in water can't grow a leaf. The water, of course, needs water to grow, but it has to come out of the water. It has to dry up to a certain extent. It has to take time. Leaves don't grow overnight. So that's the answer. That Noach sends a yoina, sends this dove. It comes back with a newly plucked olive leaf that had just grown. Noach says, there's olive trees, I don't care where they are, there's olive trees there that are growing new leaves. That means the water, there's a lot of time, that the water must be quite low. So he knows it's getting closer to being able to go out of the teva. And that's, with that, everything becomes answered. That's where the olive tree came. You don't need Eretz Yisrael or Gan Eden, but you do need that it's an olive tree, an old olive tree, but a new olive leaf. And that's why he knew the time. Just to end up with the Vart, it's interesting, Noach is making so many preparations to go out. On an interesting spiritual level, it works like this. We know the Baal Shem Tov explained that the Teva symbolizes a certain experience which we all have to have. The word Teva, the word for ark, comes from the word Teva actually means word. When we talk about the words of davening or the words of learning, we say Tevois HaTfila, the words of davening. So sometimes a person has to know there are two parts of the Jew's experience. There's Boy Ela Teva, Tzei El HaTeva. There's sometimes when a Yid has to divorce himself or herself from the world and immerse themselves in the words of davening and learning as a protection from the spiritual turbulence of the world. And then there's sometimes where our mission is to know to leave the Teva and to go out into the world. Right? So we know that when came to Noach, it was going to be a Mabul. Hashem said, protect yourself, go into the Teva. Came to go out of the Mabul, Hashem says, go out of the Teva. However, even when we learn and we daven, we can't be oblivious to the world. What Noach does is he's in the Teva because ultimately the mission of creation is to fix the world. And therefore, even when Noach is in the Teva, he's making preparations to how his learning and davening in the Teva will be able to inspire and elevate the world outside of the Teva. In other words, not just passive in saying, listen, I'm enjoying myself in the Teva over here. This is a fantastic existence. I'm going to keep living here until I'm forced out. No. He knows that the ultimate goal is to bring Hashem into the wider world. And therefore he's really itching and he's sending out a dove and he's making preparations. He's being proactive and preparing himself for coming out of the Teva, where then he can take the inspiration he took from the Teva to elevate the rest of the world. And that's, I guess, the model which we have to understand also. We do need to sometimes run away. And that's part of why we learn and we daven. But we also have to make preparations to take that loving, davening and learning and make it change the rest of the world outside of that ark. Good.